You're listening to KDNK. I'm Bill Kite, your public affairs host for the program For Land's Sake. Today we have with us Dr. John Hausdorfer, Dean of the School of Environment and Sustainability at Western State College University, where he directs the Master in Environmental Management program and serves as the Professor of Environmental Sustainability and Philosophy. He is also a fellow with the Center for Humans and Nature in Chicago. And I'd like to welcome you, Dr. Hausdorfer, or do you prefer John?
I'll go ahead and call me John. Great to talk to you, Bill.
Thanks for being on the program today.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Today we're continuing on a different track for the discussions we had last month with High Country News contributing editor Callie Carswell about sense of place. And you, John, are the co-editor, along with Gavin Van Horn, of a new book called Wildness, Not Wilderness. Subtitle is Relations of People and Place, which you have called a new story. Can you tell about this new story about the capacity for self-renewal?
Yeah, my pleasure. And, wildness presents the opportunity for a new story. You know, for a long time in the West, the dominant culture has been living out a story, you know, it's been pretty destructive. You know, the idea that the story that rain will follow the plow, the story of manifest destiny led to things like the Dust Bowl, you know, that made a third of the continent uninhabitable, right? The story of the frontier, you know, that there's always another place we can move to or get our resources from, has kept people from really caring deeply about their place. You know, the notion that humans, you know, can control a world made for them. That story, you know, has led to Houston being underwater, you know, and, you know, Puerto Rico having 70,000 refugees. It's a story that needs to change. And we need a new story that puts us as members of the ecological community, not conquerors of that community. And so the Wildness book really tries to understand, you know, how can we find wildness in all places, not just in our wilderness areas. And I'm a passionate wilderness advocate. You know, I'm proud that we have 110 million acres of wilderness designated areas on our public lands.
Absolutely.
Yeah, but wildness, you know, is something that's part of wilderness, but also found elsewhere. Wildness is the capacity for any place or community or ecosystem to renew itself, right? And you find that in a wilderness area. You know, if you have wolves on the landscape, they help that place renew itself in terms of balancing, say, deer populations and avoiding overgrazing of those deer. But you can also have, you know, self-renewal in the inner city of Chicago if you have community members, you know, fighting to clean up their neighborhood and fighting to address their food desert from having local food. That's the capacity for self-renewal as well.
Yeah, I believe it was Eliot Porter who said, "In wildness is the preservation of the world." I think that was his quote. He might have quoted it from someone else, but I do remember that from the Sierra Club in the 60s in one of his coffee table books. So what prompted you and Gavin to write this book?
Well, you know, Gavin and I, you know, as I said, you know, we're both passionate advocates for wilderness areas. You know, we need wilderness areas to preserve biodiversity in an era that's going to bring about species extinction. I get a lot of hope from wilderness areas. It also gives us a scientific baseline, and it gives us a place to go and be recharged, right? So we love wilderness. But we felt that there had been a sort of neglect of the places where we live and the places where all peoples live around the world, that we didn't want an environmental movement just fighting for places that are far away that few of us will visit, but places that are in our own backyard. In particular, we wanted to really understand the wildness that's possible in places where humans have not always had voice. You know, there's a real disproportionate impact of environmental problems, as we've seen in places like Flint, Michigan, on communities of color, on developing world communities. And we thought that if we could work with our authors to find wildness everywhere, then we could encourage readers to fight for wildness everywhere and to fight with the people who would benefit from that wildness in those places.
I think you've pretty much answered the question, the difference between wildness and wilderness. I myself am a wilderness advocate and taught all my four girls when they were 5 and 6 by taking them into the wilderness what it really means, which I think is what people need to experience wilderness to understand maybe even wildness better.
Well put. And, you know, I just took my 10-year-old and 7-year-old daughters in the West Elk Wilderness, which is one of the wilderness areas that sort of divides Gunnison and your area and the Roaring Fork, and you're in Glenwood, right?
Right.
You know, it was incredible. It was the humility, you know, that comes from the massiveness of that place. And we got lost one day. And just the importance of kids getting lost, you know, and not using a screen to get back.
And having the confidence to know they can exist in that environment and do so with pleasure and also awe and, of course, humility. But, yeah, that's great. I think people that are parents really should introduce their kids to wilderness as soon as possible.
Well, and it woke up a kind of wildness in them. And by that, I don't mean that they were, like, you know, taking their clothes off and running around the forest naked,
right.
Although they may have done that. Right. I mean that, you know, that wildness is also a kind of, you know, that self-renewal, you know, that kind of innovation and understanding how to be in a place and continue to thrive in a place. When they were lost, you know, I asked them to really start to identify the land, look at the maps, try to understand where we were, and the creativity that came from them in terms of the solutions they suggested awakened a kind of wildness from them that you don't see in a daily consumer society.
Absolutely, absolutely. You were involved in a program. I don't know whether to call it a program. It's a coalition called the Mountain Resilience Coalition. Could you describe that for us a little bit?
Yeah, and so the Mountain Resilience Coalition brings together some really brilliant partners from Aspen International Mountain Foundation and Telluride Institute and my own School of Environment and Sustainability. And we formed in Rome last December at the United Nations Mountain Partnership meeting. And we've been charged with the responsibility of helping particularly the Aspen organization. Together, we are leading the region of North America, Central America, and Caribbean mountain communities and trying to understand what are the unique challenges of being a mountain community in the age of climate change. What are unique solutions that are emerging from those communities? How do we build solidarity across mountain communities between the developed and developing world? And how can our region of North America, Central America, and the Caribbean create models of success that other United Nations regions, mountain regions, can follow? And so I run a master's program where in the second year students have to complete a major project for an organization, get something done on the ground rather than write a thesis. And we put out about 25,000 hours a year of those projects around the world. And so I actually have a team of 12 grad students doing the on-the-ground work of listening to communities from this region and helping Aspen and Telluride get things done to meet the UN goals.
You know, I was involved when I was with the Forest Service a few years ago with starting up what we call the Future Forest Roundtable, where the White River National Forest meets with partners, you know, quarterly and trying to figure out how do we prepare for the change that's going to come with the forest from climate change. So I'll have to connect you with Scott Fitzwilliams, the forest supervisor, and see if you guys can't get together and do some projects then.
Well, I'd love that. And also would love, you know, his wisdom methodologically, because, you know, we don't want this to be a top-down initiative in which, you know, affluent Colorado ski towns are telling communities in Panama what to do. We want this to be roundtable style, where every mountain community has an equal seat at the table in identifying how do we measure a healthy mountain community, and how do we each, in an equitable way, leverage resources to achieve those goals. And that's, we don't want this to repeat some of the mistakes of environmental colonialism. There's a tough history there where, you know, historically well-meaning environmentalists have removed indigenous peoples to create national parks and things like that. We really want this to be a co-production of solutions across communities.
Absolutely. And most people don't know that in Colorado, the Mesa Verde National Park was carved out of the Ute Mountain Ute Reservation. And, you know, actually, I think that's one of those kind of things of colonial environmentalism that just doesn't work when you do that with Native peoples.
That's right. Actually, my first book is called Catlin's Lament. It dealt with this, you know, to create the first Yellowstone. The Bannock were removed to create the first Yosemite. The Western Shoshone were removed, you know. And so it's a tough history there. In fact, this, and it's still continuing, right? The Trump administration took an incredible amount of acreage from the Ute Mountain Ute and other tribal communities in reducing bears' ears. And in fact, I want your listeners to know that we have a free conference coming up October 12th to 14th here, where Regina Lopez White Skunk, one of the true leaders of that Bears Ears effort, is going to be speaking here at Western.
Oh, that'd be great. I'd like to attend that. We had the show here. One of the shows was about that reduction in bears' ears and how significant that was.
Yeah, and you know, make no mistake, this is 21st century Indian removal.
Absolutely. You know? Because they spent 2 years working with people like Charles Wilkinson. And Charles wrote the most, I think, the most succinct background for that legislation, and you can read it online. It's amazing what they went through to try to get that, and then just to throw it away.
Yeah, and you know, it's not over yet, and it's really empowering to listen to Ms. Lopez White Skunk, and you know, actually, it's going to follow the National Wilderness Workshop. So we're going to have quite a week here, and be great to connect with some of your community members over here.
And tell us again one more time about the date and where it's going to be.
Sure. The National Wilderness Workshop will be held here at Western in Gunnison October 9th to 12th, and then that'll flow into the Headwaters Conference October 12th to 14th.
Okay, great.
Yeah. Miss White Skunk will be the evening of the 13th.
Super.
Afternoon.
You're listening to KDNK's Public Affairs Program for Land's Sake. Our guest today is Dr. John Hausdorfer. Get that right in a minute, John. How can more diverse communities connect with wildness?
Well, you know, I'm really glad you asked that. It's such an important question given the history you and I are just talking about. Not only do you have the history of, you know, Native peoples being removed from their land, to make national parks, but a couple authors in my book, a woman named Mistinget Smith and a gentleman named Michael Howard, are African-American authors who talk about in their community, you know, when they discuss the woods, people talk about, you know, why a lot of their people left the South because of what happened in the woods, you know, and so there's some cultural trauma for a number of cultural communities that go with the forest. And so it's not just a matter of, you know, creating youth programs to connect underserved populations with wilderness areas. We also have to take on what is wilderness and how do we challenge the historical whiteness that's gone with wilderness. Wilderness is a privileged space historically. How do we redefine wilderness so it's more attractive and more safer, you know, an experience. A great example is one of the chapters in Wildness by Michael Howard and Mike Bryson. They talk about how on the south side of Chicago, Michael Howard took the third worst lead contaminated soil in the United States, a community with that soil, and a toxic dump where gangs made drug deals and dumped bodies, and he cleaned it up, faced a lot of violence, took on a city that didn't want to hear him, cleaned it up, got NSF funding to put in a prairie and forest, put in a farm. And at first, families didn't want their kids to go out there because, you know, their family narratives of what happened in the woods. But by the end of the first year, not only were people comfortable there, the family said, yeah, go ahead and take my kids to the boundary waters. And then when they returned from the boundary waters, there was wildness in their neighborhood they could still connect with. And so I think we need a launch pad and a landing pad, right? Right. In all communities, where there's, like I said, find and fight for wildness everywhere. And so if we have that in each place and that deep connection where people from all communities can feel that comfort of home connected to wildness, now we're talking about, you know, wilderness is a place for everybody.
And it should be, for sure.
Absolutely. In fact, I think wilderness is one of the great barometers of whether or not we're a socially just society. We're not a socially just society until wilderness feels equally safe to everybody.
You say something in one of the talks I heard. I think it was Wilkinson Library in Telluride, was it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Back in March, and you mentioned something that rang true with me because you know, I was in the Forest Service for a long time, loved going into wilderness areas, and you talked about wilderness designation is really zoning, and could you explain that a little bit because it's perfect description.
Oh, well, you know, thank you. I came up with it because actually a colleague of mine in graduate school named Kevin Marsh helped me with it because 20 or so years ago when I was in grad school, there was a big debate over wilderness where a lot of progressive environmentalist academics became troubled with wilderness based on an essay by a man named William Cronin where they thought, wait a minute, you know, calling it wilderness used to be someone's homeland. So how can you call someone's homeland wilderness, right?
Exactly.
And And what I sort of ended up saying was, look, you know, maybe wilderness as the ideal goal of a movement is problematic culturally, historically, but as a form of zoning, it's very important, right? Just like you wouldn't want necessarily McDonald's, right, in your neighborhood. We have zoning for that. In the same way, 110 million acres of our public lands are zoned to be places where you can't have mechanized vehicles or industrial activity. And, you know, and that's a smart kind of zoning if you want to promote biodiversity. What we're starting to see now, though, is taking that even further in two ways, right? One is people like the great Earth Firster Dave Foreman are saying, now we need to connect wilderness areas so there are migratory corridors so keystone predators can balance populations across large landscapes. And two, as Gavin and I have been talking about, you know, among others, how do we find that wildness, that power of wilderness everywhere? And I think those two aspects are the future of where wilderness needs to go. It's not just about more acres. It's about sort of rethinking why we have it.
And that's a very important thing because the species diversity depends upon them being outside of that particular area they're in and connecting with other, through corridors, connecting with other habitats that they can thrive in.
That's right. And that's where human wildness comes in again in two ways, right? Human wildness in terms of, you know, if I'm going to connect Fossil Ridge wilderness with the West Elk wilderness, that means, you know, a predator being able to get across the Gunnison Valley, across Highway 135, right? And so how does that involve homeowners associations and their view of wildness and their cooperation with wildness? How does that involve the highway department? How does that involve ranchers? How does it involve BLM, et cetera? Right, and so to connect those corridors, we need to start to embrace wildness everywhere. And then there's a wildness in us that needs to be woken up. Our creativity, for the sake of the more than human world, needs to be woken up.
Very, very well put. Tell us how your work goes beyond the pages of the wilderness book and to connect with a place like Carbondale, for instance.
Well, in a couple of ways, you know. One is I mentioned the master's program I run and how, you know, we get about 40 students a year in that graduate program. They're each required to do a 600-hour project for a community organization. And so the idea of finding and fighting for wildness everywhere, if there are, you know, nonprofit organizations or landowners or agency leaders listening and they want to get projects off the back burner, they can reach out to me to get master's projects done to do this kind of work. But secondly, Gavin's had a real visionary idea. He wants to start an organization that is literally an institute where we promote the kinds of stories found in our book to occur in more kinds of places and to work with people from those places to find that story of wildness, to find that story of ecological, cultural, personal self-renewal, and to make it happen, to write that story onto the land and with their community members. And so we're calling it Story Shed for Wildness and Diversity, and that's where we really want the book to come to life. And I think master's projects are a way of helping communities bring that kind of story shed work to life, you know, make that kind of wildness work of, like, finding and fighting for wildness everywhere happen in their communities. You know, but we want communities to sort of tell the stories of their own place, not only through that sense of place and their role in that place, but also through doing the work of humans as co-creators of wildness, right? And you have, right. We've already shown we can be preservers of wilderness, with wilderness areas, right? But a couple chapters in here show that we can co-create wildness.
And that's the thing. People want to be involved, I think, anymore in activism of actually doing something. And, you know, as a storyteller myself, it's really important to know how to tell that story so that other people actually listen and it touches their heart. So we have a program here in the Valley called, basically, it's a storyteller called Writ Large, the Writ Large Project, where you tell your story in 7 minutes. And so I think it'd be beneficial creatively to teach those students also how to tell that story.
That's right. And I think that we're seeing storytelling emerge in a lot of corners. You know, you look at, 98% of scientists view climate change as caused by humans and an urgent crisis, and what, just over half of Americans and under half of legislators. And so there's a huge story gap there between the data and the public understanding, where it's either not compelling enough data or it's not being explained through story in a way that moves people and how they live in their places.
Right.
I think it's a crisis of story.
I do too. And moving people is, stories do that, because that's how we've has been humans for thousands and thousands of years, is telling stories around the campfire.
Huh. Yeah, and there's a good argument to be made for our evolution relying on storytelling, that, you know,
right.
we don't necessarily have great survival advantages physically. Right? We're pretty vulnerable when
that's
we're born.
True.
You know, and so our ability to organize and share cultural identity through story. Story has been a way of mapping the landscape, right, before we drew maps.
Exactly.
It's hard to know how we would have evolved without story.
There's a book called Wisdom Sets in Places by an anthropologist who says exactly that, that stories are really a map. I can't remember his name now, but good book. What project are you working on now, John?
Well, you know, I think one of my two essays in the Wildness book opens with the question, what kind of ancestor do you want to be? And I'm not satisfied with the answer that I came to in that essay, and so I decided the opening line of that essay is the title of the new book, and Melissa Nelson and Keith Cummings and Brooke Hecht, some friends from the Center for Humans and Nature, are co-editing with me this volume called What Kind of Ancestor Do You Want to Be? And we're having people think about how is that question answered by the land?
Very
you know
good.
That
very good, yes.
Right?
Uh-huh.
We may or may not be remembered by our descendants, but whether we know it or not, whether we like it or not, our values are passed on through what we leave on the land. Just like, you know, the the chaos theorists who say, you know, the flap of a butterfly's wing can cause a hurricane.
Right.
Each of our choices leaves an ancestry on the land, right? So how do we become more aware and deliberate about those choices? How do we read the land in terms of how are we living?
You know, and we owe it to our ancestors. Look at what it took to get us to where we are as human beings in the generation we live in. And I think that there's an obligation there, I feel, to carry on something that is lasting.
Yeah, I truly agree. I was really challenged once. Winona LaDuke, the great indigenous leader, came to Gunnison to give a talk, and she opened with a picture of a squash. And she said, this is an 800-year-old squash. Archaeologists dug it up on her reservation, White Earth in Minnesota, and, you know, they wanted to preserve it. You know, they wanted to put it in a museum. And her people made a strong case for it belonging to the reservation, and they won. And they cracked it open and planted the seeds.
Oh, great. I love it.
And she said to the crowd, you know, what about your society will still matter in 800 years? You know, it's an 800-year-old squash. And the systems were still in place to know what to do with that squash 800 years later.
Right.
You know,
exactly.
And, you know, what will we have that matters to us now in 800 years? That's the measurement of sustainability.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And that's the ancestor question.
If you had all the resources that you would need, money, influence, power, what would you like to accomplish in the next couple of minutes we have left?
Well, I really feel responsible as a citizen of the mountains, as somebody who benefits recreationally and economically from living in the mountains. I feel a deep responsibility to give back to the health of the mountains, to stable snowpack, to healthy and just human communities, to ecological resilience. And so it's a real opportunity, and it's a real honor to be working with my friends from Aspen International Mountain Foundation, Telluride Institute, on the Mountain Resilience Coalition. Folks can Google it. We're really trying to fund those efforts so we can show the UN a true model for mountain community resilience and solidarity. That's what I want to accomplish. I want to see a carbon neutral, climate adaptive mountain region by 2050. So that not only can my great-great-grandkids have powder days like me, but that, the ecosystems and cultures that thrive on the Colorado River, making it across the West, are still there. You know, that's it. That's my vision. You know, that's why I write about being a good ancestor. That's why I write about wildness. That's why I created the master's program that tried to change communities through empowering students with these projects. And that's what it's all about.
Great, John. I really appreciate you being with us today. It's been a pleasure, and may your work continue.
Oh, thank you so much, Bill. Have a great day.